All right, great. All right. Thanks to organizers for having me. I'm really excited to be here today. So I'll be here to talk about type 1a supernovae as the middle person. I tried to make it non-gender specific. Okay, so I was saying to Wendy earlier this morning that I feel with all of this, the big winner is Twitter. So I was looking at this in detail and made a plot that I think we've been seeing a lot. I saw this tension that I found odd. So on the left side here, I'm showing people who mostly tweet about cosmology. So this is the same kind of ideogram. And on the right side, I show people who never tweet about cosmology. So there's Dance going, Graham, Lloyd, Tamara. And I find 10 to the fifth sigma tension. So I'm pretty sure this is new physics that I'm uncovering. And I learned that tweeting about cosmology is just not going to get your followers. But this is fun regardless. All right, so let's get into it. Okay, so one point I often try to make is that the measurement of H-naught is on the supernova side significantly easier than the measurement of W. So for W, we care about measuring basically a 1% difference comparing Z, lower redshift to higher redshift. Whereas for H-naught, what we care about is, you know, roughly like a 4-ish% difference, and you're comparing kind of very low redshift to low redshift. Now, for W, that's besides just kind of the scale, you have to worry a lot more about the systematics. So for H-naught, really, the key thing is to make sure on the supernova side, well, for the whole distance ladder generally, you really want to make sure the rungs are as self-consistent as possible. So on the supernova side, you want to make sure that these supernovae are as similar in how you observe them, same filters, same systems, same bias corrections, same galaxy properties, same everything between the second rung and the third rung. For W, this is just naturally harder because we have to use different surveys for low redshift and high redshift. That means you have things like K corrections, different surveys, different filters, and you have to worry about evolution. It's just, you can't get out of this being harder. But kind of for me, if I try to worry a lot about W, then kind of H-naught comes off of that pretty well. All right. Now, the big thing that I worked on previously was the Pantheon sample. So that combined Pan-STARRS and SNLS, SDSS. It kind of was like Pan-STARRS, a new low redshift sample, plus JLA, which is kind of like the predecessor. And it's amazing to see kind of how far we've come. So this is from the kind of two discovery papers of dark energy with a kind of small amount of supernovae. So that was 20 years ago. This is from the Pantheon paper. And so you could see kind of in the Riesel 98 paper, this was the omega lambda omega matter contour. And then here's where we're at now. So, you know, the long arc of science seems like it works. That's the takeaway, even though kind of when you're in the middle of it, kind of as we are now, it feels like crazy. Okay. All right. Now, as Pantheon has been kind of reanalyzed, there have been kind of certain, you know, funnies, curiosities, whatever this should be called, and these are expected. So this is basically a systematic error table, but kind of as a figure, so you kind of get a sense of the scale of the systematics. So the systematics do have certain structure, but these are all kind of on the 1 to 2% level or lower, whereas the kind of tension that we've been talking about is all on the 0.2 mag. So this is kind of in mags is 0.01 to 0.02 tensions, you know, almost 0.2 mag. Now there's kind of one systematic I just want to point out since this comes up. This is due to the intrinsic scatter. You can see as this is like a weird shape. This will come up. This has to do with understanding the scatter of the residuals of type 1a supernovae.
What is this?
So this is if you change, if you do your analysis and then you change one assumption in your analysis. So this is like change how you do the salt calibration, change what you say about the intrinsic scatter, change what you say about your selection bias. So every systematic, this is kind of how much it changes your distances. Make sense?
Well, except that if you have these things parameterized, why don't you marginalize
them? Well, so that goes, this is basically what makes up the error table. So this is like 2% in W. This is 1-ish percent in W. So these go into W, and that's included in our final systematic table. So I mean, if you marginalize over them, it's the same thing as just including them as systematics. I mean, that's essentially what we're doing with our covariance matrix. But yeah, so but this is what I give when I give the covariance matrix.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Now, one of the key things for this analysis was trying to calibrate all the samples onto kind of a homogeneous system. So PANSLRS observed 3 pi of the sky, and what I could do is cross-calibrate PANSTARRS to every other optical system, optical filter. So here you're just seeing different supernova samples and the different filters, and finding these small offsets. What I try to do is say, okay, let's get everything to be homogeneous, and I'm going to take out all these offsets so that when you're combining PANSTARRS and a CSP sample or a CFA sample or SNLS, they're all in the same system. And you know, this is the was the top systematic for supernova cosmology. Now, for, you could say, okay, well, how much does this matter for HNOT? So this is showing all the different samples we can use for HNOT. So R16 was this red line here. Since R16 has come out, there's been a new foundation sample, and there's a new CSP data release. And this moves it on the order of, these samples move it on the order of 0.6%, as you could see here. But overall, the scatter is actually surprisingly good to me. So it scatters well around the mean, and considering that we have systematics, you know, on this scale, or hopefully smaller because we tried taking them out, this is showing that a lot of the variation between the samples is really just statistical, and is actually quite encouraging. And you remember when we talk about the tension, this uncertainty is still 0.4% in the mean, whereas the tension is all the way out here, 9%. So this is critical to think about, but can't explain the tension. All right. Now, one of the big things that we try to do in Pantheon is we try to do these, we call them bias corrections. So from simulations, you don't need to know anything else besides the demographics of your supernova color and your supernova stretch, and then use simulations. You can predict biases that you should see in your data. And so here, this is showing Hubble residuals, so your distance modulus minus your best fit versus color, and your distance modulus minus your best fit versus stretch. And basically, simulations for different scatter models are the red and the blue, and the black points are the data. So there are biases that we expected to be in our data according to our simulations, and we see these with 15 sigma. So this is not like you have to go out and find some extra host galaxy property or anything. This is just something that it has to do with having underlying narrow populations of color and stretch. And as long as you know you could solve for what those are at the same time, you could correct for this. So this is just a much bigger, more important correction than any of the host things that I'll talk about in a second. All right, now this is a confusing public service announcement, but a lot of people are now using Pantheon, and they're kind of used to using JLA, so I tried making the files look as similar as possible, but with Pantheon, I basically just give the redshifts and the distances, and in a separate file, I give a bunch of the extra fit parameter information, but that's all there. The reason that I tried putting everything together is that what I found is that you have to do things simultaneously to be self-consistent. What JLA does is basically they plop on the bias corrections onto the brightness term, but then if someone is trying to fit for their own alpha and beta and do anything like that, you're then using these bias corrections that don't go with whatever else you're doing. So to prevent that, I say, okay, here's everything. It's done simultaneous, and it's tried to minimize the model dependence, the cosmological model dependence. So it's same format, but it seems like I'm giving less information only because I am trying to prevent people from doing the wrong thing. But you could still take Pantheon and do exactly what you do with JLA. I'm just trying to be more self-consistent. This point keeps coming up. All right, now there's a lot of discussion with W and with HNOT about this kind of extra standardization parameter. And What was used in shoes and what's used in Pantheon is what's called the mass-luminosity relation. So this is a plot from Batu et al. Showing Hubble residuals versus host galaxy mass. It's not the easiest thing to see. It's a much smaller correction than everything else we talk about, but it's been seen, and we correct for that. So in shoes we correct for that, in Pantheon we correct for that. That is taken out in all of our baseline analyses. But then the question is, okay, well, maybe the host galaxy mass is not the right parameter. Maybe it's some other host galaxy parameter. All right. So one thing that's gotten stirred up is these papers by Mikhail Rigaut, and he says, okay, it's not the host galaxy mass, it's actually the specific star formation of the galaxies. Now, what's particularly difficult about this is that he sees this effect in the supernova factory data, which is more than a decade old, and it's not public, so no one can reanalyze this and see it. And also, how they take the data is actually very different than how we do in any of the samples that we use for Pantheon or shoes or whatever. And that's that they're using this IFU, this spectrograph, where it's very hard to subtract out the galaxy light. So it's a different kind of measurement. So it's really hard to be apples to apples and understand kind of where that is. And anytime we try looking for the effect in our sample, we just don't see it. Now, what one of the claims is the reason that we don't see it is because there's something very special about the shoe sample. And my point for that is that we now have a complete set for all z less than 0.01 late type hosts. So for our sample to be special, it has to be that the universe somehow has told supernovae to be different close to us versus far away, and that just seems difficult. Okay, now Dave Jones will go into this because he's led a number of these studies, but I just want to show the kind of final effect all these different host galaxy things make. And so we look at a bunch of different host galaxy properties because we're not sure what is the thing. But if you just look at kind of the effect on H0 from R16, you could see this is kind of a mean of minus 0.31, and that's small. And then kind of for the next big analysis that we're working on, where we've doubled the calibrator set, this mean will be a minus 0.1. So we're a little bit sensitive to it. It's just not the story here, and the future will be barely sensitive to it at all. Anyone could take our samples and kind of do this analysis, and it's just this step just kind of, it's not seen, and our demographics are preventing it from being serious. Okay, now there's this fun thing that I'm working on, which is it's going to keep coming out that there's some new host galaxy property that is really the thing. So how do you actually just kind of knock this out? So with DES, we have the biggest sample of type 1a supernovae. And if you have enough supernovae, and you look at enough galaxies, you're going to start finding supernovae that, so you're going to find galaxies that host multiple supernovae. So I call this supernova siblings, because they have the same parent galaxy. So with DS, we have 9 of them, and we can then analyze kind of how correlated are the supernovae when they share parents. So is it nature versus nurture? It would be the question. Okay, so these then are the light curves of the pairs of when a galaxy hosts 2 supernovae, how similar are the light curves. And you could see by eye that they're quite different, actually. I mean, if you just look here, this is same band, same galaxy, kind of right on top of each other, just occurred at different times. But these light curves are really different. It's not, the galaxy is not prescribing the properties of the supernovae. And so you could kind of actually say something, how much does the galaxy tell you what the properties of the supernova should be. So this is just a correlation plot of the different light curve parameters that we measure from the pair. So this is just pair 1 versus pair 2. And you can see there's not amazing agreement. Then we could go one step further. We could say, okay, well, what's the chi-square that you get in just, this is the distance modulus. So the chi-squared for this sample is here, which is basically what you'd expect given normal intrinsic scattered, normal random population of type 1a supernovae. So basically it's saying that these supernovae agreed no better than just two random supernovae in different galaxies. So we could rule out that it could explain the whole intrinsic scatter. And it's actually not, you know, it's kind of on the wrong side of the distribution for just normal supernovae. This is 1 times intrinsic scatter. This is 0 times intrinsic scatter. As shown here, with LSST, we'll really be able to nail this down because we'll have, instead of 9 siblings, we'll have 900 or 1,000 of these. And you can really say precisely what is the host galaxy contributing to this. Okay. All right. Now, Adam kind of mentioned this briefly yesterday about how local voids can, whether local voids can explain things. And in R16, we had this plot showing delta H over H versus the minimum redshift. And we saw that this wasn't changing at all. The one problem with this plot is that by keeping the minimum, by only varying the minimum redshift, then the higher redshift supernovae are correlated. So what we Adam and I had with a paper with Darcy Kenworthy, it just breaks it into bins. So this is looking at the intercept here, this is the y-axis here, but showing the variation H-naught. And you can see that there's just kind of not much variation going all the way from z of 0.01 to 0.5. So if there was a void, as has been claimed to explain it, you should really be seeing jumps on the size of like the blue here, and we don't see anything like that. So there's just no evidence for a void, and supernovae really are just like the perfect thing to check this, because we could check all the way from 0.01 or from 0 to 0.5. So you can say, okay, well what's happening? And so we think that when people are making the void models, the part of the sky they're looking at just doesn't cover enough sky. So kind of the sampling used for the void models is probably just not full enough, and that's why they're kind of there saying, all right, there's some voids. But the amount of sky they're looking at is 15 to 20%. Supernovae kind of have similar issues in that they don't happen all across the sky, but I think that they're just more accurate, and we could trace this better to higher redshift. Okay. Now, another thing that's come up is that, okay, well, maybe this H-naught tension can be recast as omega M tension. So this is a paper that came out a couple months ago and got a lot of attention. This is by Colgain et al., and basically said, okay, if you vary the maximum redshift, so before I was showing the minimum redshift varying, now I'm showing the maximum redshift of the Pantheon sample, this is how omega M changes with redshift. They had a good referee who pointed out some problems that they had, and this is their latest version. So you can see that basically the uncertainties are much bigger. They had like a bug and didn't include systematics. But so yeah, I mean, there is variation, and actually there's this nice plot from the Planck paper showing, this kind of, you could see like some structure here, right? And so if you just cut off the minimum redshift right here, then you're going to pick up a little bit of that, and I think that's what's happening. Now, I pointed out earlier in this talk this intrinsic scatter systematic, and that's kind of has exactly the same structure. And I could have made a choice with the analysis to make this perfectly flat if I wasn't honest, but we don't know about intrinsic scatter, and it causes this effect. So this just doesn't seem, surprising, especially when you account for systematics. Okay. All right, so Pantheon seems to be holding up. It's in very good agreement with latest results from DES that Dylan Brout will talk about, and the Pan-SAR's photometric sample that Dave Jones will talk about. Now, all these samples share common low redshift supernovae, and so as we replace with new samples, like Foundation's ETF, we'll kind of have less correlation between these big analyses. But everything right now is seeing W of -1 within 1 sigma. Okay, all right, so now on to like the fun stuff. I'm actually not going to really talk about the fun stuff, so I'm going to leave that to the afternoon. But I want to make a plea to leave the supernova out of this, so that this is going to be my hot take. So my whole thing is that supernovae, as we keep seeing, are the middleman or the middle person. Now, in Freeman and others that came out last night, there's this nice plot that showed if you calibrate the same 10 supernovae with TRGB versus Cepheid. So you're keeping the supernova part exactly the same, then you get a 0.093 mag difference, which is the whole story right there. Now, if you do this direct comparison between Cepheids and TRGB, it's 0.06. And really what supernovae are doing, like by, it's not just like the transitive property, they're increasing the uncertainties, and that's changing the weighting of TRGB versus Cepheids. But this is the story. Yesterday, Adam talked about this zero-point calibration difference of 0.08 mag. So I think that instead of, we shouldn't be talking about supernovae. The discussion should be about the zero point and leave supernova alone. So that's my defense. Yeah, I just want to have popcorn and be by myself. Okay. Now, with that being said, I am stoked about this new analysis. So in Freeman et al., they use Burns et al., and that's why I kind of go through some of the things that they should enjoy in the many reanalyses they'll now get. So the kind of four points that I want to make. The first is kind of based on what I've talked about, which is that the team for the Hubble flow set used CSP supernovae. And then for the calibrated set, because you have to go back into the distant past, it's just a mixed match of different sets. So you kind of have these calibration problems. Now, I'll give the context for this. The overall agreement kind of on the supernova side with regards to H0 seems to be 0.5 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So this doesn't seem to be the big thing, but these are the gotchas. So that you have kind of these calibration differences. So if CSP is a little bit to the left and the other samples are a little bit to the right, that's important. Now, the other thing that this Burns et al. Paper does is it has to do with this mass correction. And basically, all the other papers that are out there are basically saying there's some step. This Burns et al. Basically solves for this slope. And the problem is that on the low mass end, they have very few galaxies that are there, and almost all those galaxies are calibrator galaxies. So this means that the mass correction and H0 become very degenerate. Now, if they would use the supercal sample, which they do, and measure the mass step from that, you're insensitive to it. But because you don't have points here, and the only points really are these red points, then this linear mass correction and H0 are very hard to separate. And you could see, like for this guy, if this point here is driving it, and that's a 0.2 mag correction. So that's huge compared to any of these host galaxy corrections that we're doing. And it's just because it's using this CSP sample for the Hubble flow sample, where you don't have leverage on the low mass end. Now, the other thing is just has to do with peculiar velocity corrections. So Freeman et al. Uses peculiar velocity corrections for the calibrator set, but not the Hubble flow set. So there's been a number of papers on what's the issue due to cosmic variance? And this is a nice plot by Wu and Hooter that shows delta H0 versus Zmax. And basically, if you don't go to high enough redshift, you're very susceptible to peculiar velocities or cosmic variance, whatever you want to call it. So the CSP set really goes up to Z of 0.06. There's like a few greater than 0.06. So the cosmic variance number for delta H0 will actually be a pretty large uncertainty. And that wouldn't be the case for using something like SuperCal, because SuperCal goes to 0.15, where you can see this converge. So those are kind of the main things that I say are the gotchas kind of that they get to enjoy over the next year. Okay. In terms of, I'm doing good at time. Okay. Okay. In terms of other analyses, so there's one by Saurabh Jha, Sohail Dhawan. And they basically looked at a near-infrared, they did near-infrared H0 measurement. They also get kind of H0 of 72.8 with kind of small statistical uncertainty, bigger systematic uncertainty. Their systematic uncertainty is really due to them not understanding this intrinsic scatter. So kind of I was talking about this problem on the optical side. This is in the near-infrared. But overall good agreement. And I'll say that, I was just talking about this burn sample that was used in Friedman et al. And on the for the optical side, they also get 72.8. So, but they're calibrating to R16 for the Cepheid side. So again, kind of on the supernova side, if you're tying everything back to the R16 Cepheid side, you're getting something right around 73. And that seems to be consistent across samples. Okay, now kind of stepping away from the local distance ladder, what's been mentioned is that you could also use supernovae as part of a reverse distance ladder. So this is a nice plot from Feeney et al. That uses Pantheon, but calibrated by BAO and the sound horizon. So kind of the same supernovae that are used in the local distance ladder, calibrated by Cepheids, can be used with BAO, calibrated by BAO in the sound horizon, and those give you a low H-naught. So this is kind of this overall point that supernovae are just kind of the middle agent here. Now, similarly, this has been talked about yesterday, but you could combine supernovae with strong lens systems, and basically supernovae are removing the model dependence assumptions that the strong lens analyses need, and you could see doing that, you get a high value H-naught. So supernovae with strong lens give high H-naught, supernovae with BAO give low H-naught. Okay, so what's fun for me is that, you know, how are we getting to this 1%? So Adam talked about this a bit, but this rung keeps improving. The uncertainty in this rung is small, and really the focus now is how do we reduce the uncertainty in the middle rung? And really what's driving the uncertainty, the H-naught, is the total scatter of type 1a supernovae. So as we push from 19 to 38, that'll start driving our H-naught uncertainty down. But it's interesting that, you know, supernova uncertainty are driving the H-naught uncertainty at this point. And, you know, what we have to keep worrying about is how do we make these two rungs as similar as possible so we could keep the systematics going down with it. All right, now I'll just say one word about kind of what's next. So this is just a distribution of the number of supernovae that LSST will measure. So in solid, this is kind of good measurements, in dash, that's not so good. And basically the number is 400,000 or so. So yeah, I've been talking about a sample of 1,000, and with LSST, we're gonna multiply that by 400. So hey, we'll have way more type 1 supernovae than anyone knows what to do with, but any kind of systematic question, I feel, is gonna get answered with LSST. It doesn't help that much for H-naught in the sense of improving the statistics of the calibrator set, but every other question of, you know, what's going on with this with supernovae, LSST will handle. Okay, so I'll just give my conclusions. So now I have this interesting picture of Cepheids and supernovae, high H-naught, strong lens and supernovae, high H-naught, BAO and supernovae, low H-naught, TRGB and supernovae, mid H-naught, and we'll get into that. So we're working on our next big shoe analysis where we double the calibrator set, and that'll reduce the error in the mean from the second round of the distance ladder, and we're open to all systematic checks. And, you know, we still don't have some great theory to explain anything, but, you know, we don't understand dark energy or dark matter or anything else. So let's all be confused together. So thanks.
Nice talk, Dan. So you are showing the Burns et al. Plots for the Cepheid data, but speaking about TRGB in some cases. So that we have a similar figure. One of the advantages of the TRGB is that we can observe that the red giant branch stars in both ellipticals and spirals, galaxies of any type. So we actually cover the mass range of the distant sample very well, and we don't see this effect that was seen in the Burns earlier paper that was calibrated with the Cepheid. So you're showing the Cepheid plot here.
I see what you're saying. So you're saying that this is Cepheid as a TRGB. So I thought, though, that the supernovae that are in the TRGB calibrated supernovae are still majority late type host.
They're majority, but we cover the mass range well. We just don't see this effect that we saw for the Cepheids. And that's one of the advantages of the TRGB, is we can actually cover all morphological types. Whereas the Cepheids, you're stuck in spirals because they're young stars. That's for the Burns.
It'd be nice to put in like the mass correction then.
We ended up with a big paper and didn't put it in, but I'm realizing we probably should have had the paper. It speaks of this, but the plot shows it really clearly. But the other thing to say is that the I agree with your statement that it's very small difference. The supernova sample is not a big issue, but the scatter in the CSP data is smaller than for the set that you put together, the supercal.
I could definitely believe that. I mean, CSP has higher quality light curves, but we just have so many supernovae that the scatter isn't kind of what worries me.
I agree, but I agree with your statement. It's not the supernovae that are the issue. But there is a bit of a zero-point offset, and all I would say is we took great care to do the calibration of the CSP data, and we've got 9 filters. We were using tests of the filters that we checked every year to make sure they weren't varying. We used the same filters across all the telescopes that we use. It was done very carefully.
The irony of supernova cosmology is you could calibrate one sample perfectly, and that could make things worse just because if you're combining it with other samples that aren't calibrated perfectly, you get hurt. So that's, I think CSP did a great job. It's just that when you combine with other sets, then it's a problem.
I agree with your overall assessment. Yeah. You know, the things at the supernova end are agreeing really well, and I think we are just doing something completely independently of you, which I think is a positive thing.
Hey, Dan.
Yeah.
Nice talk. Nice jacket. Can you put up that slide that shows the different samples and the leans from it? Yeah. Okay. So my reading of this, and you know, tell me if this is correct, is so back in R16, we didn't have CSP in Foundation, right? And so so we had the average that you see as the dashed red line.
Yeah.
CSP, or the CCHP sample, is using only CSP for the Hubble flow. So that's the dashed line.
Yeah.
So there's a 1.2% difference, one tick in H-naught, that is different between the analysis that is just strictly the choice of samples, when the choice was made and whatnot. So there's a little piece that is supernovae and is not mysterious at all.
Yeah, right. So I think that the upper limit of this is 1.2%, whatever you see here, because if in the calibrator set that...
I have a question still for you.
Okay.
My question is why, and maybe this gets back to what Wendy and you were just talking about, CSP could be the greatest set in the world measuring perfectly, but since you're going to use it to calibrate these supernovae that are calibrators, and we're stuck with those because it's 20 years, 25 years worth of previous surveys. Like, we can't go back with CSP and observe those. Aren't we better off just using the average of all samples, because then at least we have canceled the various calibration errors rather than just have one versus the others?
Right. So yes. The perfect way to do this is you want the exact same demographics of calibration systems in your Hubble flow set as your calibrator set. So if you have 1/6 CSP in your calibrator set, you want to use 1/6 CSP in your Hubble flow set. That's how to eliminate it. So it's not just like a straight average, it's a representative average, but overall, yes.
So, you know, we discussed that in the paper. It's in there, too. We chose to go with just an independent set just to make an independent comparison.
But there are some advantages of combining, because you're using the full, you're not just using CSP for the calibrators.
Sure. But the other thing that I would say is that the dispersion in the supernova 1A magnitudes of the calibrators is smaller for the TRGB sample than it is for the Cepheid sample. So the scatter in the Cepheids is larger. It's the same.
But it's just the systematics I'm talking about. Like, let's just say for some dumb reason that when Dan did Pantheon, right, or he combined all these samples, he had some, you know, 0.02 magnitude error in them. Then, and you didn't have that in CSP, you know, you would want to cancel that.
Right. But you have to worry about whether in a larger scatter you're hiding systematics that you haven't found yet. And that's something I think we all need to think about.
Dan, are you hiding systematics?
I'll check my pockets.
You're actually hiding them. They haven't emerged yet because the scatter's larger and you can't detect it. Let me change my phrase.
Can I ask maybe the two of you, just this issue on the mass step. Yeah. I understand that it's reduced somewhat because TRGB has some different galaxies, but they're mostly overlapping. Can you describe it? How much it's reduced by? Is there?
Yeah, I will hunt up the plot. I was trying to do that in real time.
That just wasn't in the paper. So.
Yeah.
It went by fast, but you said something about the Rigaud paper. You said, I can't remember exactly what you said, but it's something like, how does the universe know that local supernovae are different? What did you mean
yeah,
by that?
Yeah, right. So basically, what the point I'm making here is in our shoe set, in our big shoe set, we are complete for all supernovae in late type hosts for Z less than 0.01.
What do you mean by complete?
Basically, if you go back for the last 40 years to 1981 or whatever, any supernova that's in a late type host is in our sample. So as long as basically key for us is to make our Hubble flow set late type hosted supernovae, then we should be insensitive to this. So my point about so if Mikkel then says, well, something special, how does supernovae know that they should be different for Z less than 0.01 compared to Z greater than 0.01? Because that's essentially what the H0 measurement is. It's comparing Z less than 0.01 to Z greater than 0.01. That makes sense?
I still don't understand. How does it relate to this Rigaud result?
So Rigaud is saying So he says there's this huge step. We don't see the step. So he says the reason we don't see the step is because our supernovae are very strange that we use in shoes. That's the new claim. So we say, well, how can it be strange when we're complete? That's the back and forth now.
But people have found differences. I mean, if you plot like color of supernovae versus redshift, like the really local ones have a much higher, like you see much redder things locally than you do as you start to go out, which is a. My point is the universe does know about the difference between local and far things because of selection effects. And so, you know, you do just have to make super careful that you fixed all those.
Yeah, but we try.
Yeah, if I may jump in on this, so talking with Mikkel about 2 weeks ago or something, I mean, I think what he says is rather that the tracers you are using is not a good tracer. It's a biased tracers of that. And according to him, he's using a better tracer of that. And that's because you're using a biased tracer that you don't see the step, basically. I think that's rather what he's saying.
Yeah.
And I mean,
right.
It's just...
Or less correlated.
Yeah, this has been a moving target. Our data is very public, and it's hard because we can't check where he's getting his signal from, and we just don't see steps that he's saying.
But I think the point Dan is making supernovae in Cepheid calibrators, which were late type galaxies, and then you had supernovae in all types of galaxies, and you could say, you know, maybe there's a difference between these where I have the right tracer to tell me that. Dan's saying if you move to this mode where you choose the host galaxies exactly the same, all things that would be Cepheid hosts nearby, all things that would be Cepheid hosts far away, then there's no reason that you could build up some kind of difference in environment. So we're going to that model. So when we go to that model, as Dan was showing, we don't see any changes. And then so Mikkel's statement has been, well, then yours are weird because, for example, you have double supernovae.
Right, yeah. So Mikkel and I were both at Cosmogol. He said, our sample is strange because we have two galaxies that have two supernovae. And first, that wasn't in R16, but second, I showed with DS, we have multiple galaxies with multiple supernovae. So, it's just... Somehow he's saying that something's very different about this our local sample, and it's unclear what that could be at this point.
Other questions? Did you have a comment out the back?
Sylvia?
Any more?
Just trying to fill in questions, but here's a question people ask all the time. What if a supernova went off in NGC 4258? Does that solve everything?
Well, still you have a huge scatter. One supernova, you're still at 7% or something in for H0 distance. So no. Unfortunately.
Sorry, Mark. We need six of them. We need a chain reaction.
We definitely need more nearby supernovae.
Yeah.
I have a question for the LSST sample.
Yeah.
What kind of follow-up do we need to get good light curves and potentially spectra for host, et cetera, of these kind to get 400,000?
Right. Well, I'm skipping the LSST desk meeting right now to be here. So the problems with LSST are that 400,000 light curves, but the light curves as designed right now are kind of crappy. And you still want host galaxy redshifts. So things like OSDES, which Tamara helps lead, they will get the, you need something like that to get redshifts, or else we're stuck in photo Z land and no one wants to be there. So it's unclear how much we could use the 400K, but if we can, it'll be the best thing ever.
Okay. Thanks very much, Dan.
Thanks, everybody.
See everyone back in half an hour.